This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit Progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. They would become gods. That was the idea. It came from a businessman, an import-export guy, connected, old Yankee money. And he knew Japan. That's how he was known, as a man who knew Japan. His home was filled with Asian antiques that announced to visitors that here lives a man who knows Japan. And this was 2 years after Pearl Harbor, when the Pacific was on fire, when General MacArthur, teeth clenched in his corncob pipe, was poring over maps, connecting the green dots and the blue, the islands they would have to seize to leapfrog across the ocean until they could take the fight to the Japanese mainland. Which was a terrifying prospect. Even for the men at the highest levels of the American military who would never have to storm a beach or clear a bunker or look the enemy in the eye. They had spent the last year in a state of perpetual dread, waiting for casualty lists to come in from the Pacific Theater. 7,100 American men killed at Guadalcanal. On Arawa, a tiny atoll, 11 square miles of sand and palms, 5,000 men went into the water, barely half of them made it onto the beach. And with those terrible numbers came terrible stories of brutal hand-to-hand combat, of Japanese soldiers who simply would not surrender. They marveled at it, the Americans, and didn't understand how, why, what was it about the culture, the educational system, the military order that would engender that spirit, the same one, they assumed, that spurred on the kamikaze pilot whose mission succeeded only if he didn't survive. It was confounding. They were confounding, the Japanese. If they fought like that, to hold on to a glorified sandbar, what would they do when the Americans attacked them at home? There was a number going around, one office's estimate of the human toll of a full-scale invasion. It predicted victory, but at the cost of a million American lives, fighting against an enemy they didn't understand. So when a businessman, an old Japan hand, claimed he did, they listened, and they got to work. Project Fantasia was launched at the end of 1943 by the Office of Strategic Service, the intelligence arm of the U.S. military during World War II. It was a psychological operation inspired by the insights of the American businessman Edgar Salinger, uncle to JFK's future press secretary Pierre, into the psychology of the Japanese people. The Japan he claimed to know so well from his importing and exporting and his collecting of their cultural treasures was under the thrall of superstitious mumbo-jumbo. Shintoism was its state religion. And if you had been to Japan, as he had, many times, as he would tell you, you would have seen many statues of foxes. These were not your average foxes. They were kitsune, which means fox in Japanese, but it also means a different kind of fox. You would know that if you knew Japan. A spirit fox. A magical creature who could read minds, who could take on human form, who could possess people and drive them mad, could curse families, bespoil crops, and could serve as messengers of the gods and lesser demons and the like, and be sent forth as omens and harbingers of doom. Mr. Salinger sat in a room with OSS agents and told them that the Japanese took such things very seriously. So while at that moment, at that dark hour, scattered around the world, some OSS agents worked in clandestine radar facilities and on top secret rocket ranges and nuclear laboratories in Los Alamos, New Mexico, other agents worked on Project Fantasia, tasked with the mission of spooking the enemy into submission. They began with balloons, fox-shaped and covered in glow-in-the-dark paint. The idea was that the balloons would be tied to the end of a fishing line and would bob in the air offshore or above the tall reeds on a mist-covered battlefield. The frontline soldiers would cry out. Words of the omen would ripple through the ranks. Morale would crumble. Posts would be abandoned. Steely trigger fingers would tremble. Meanwhile, sleeper agents, turncoats within the ranks, or even better, embedded within the population, would blow whistles specially designed to make the sounds of possessed demon foxes, whatever those sounds sound like. And some of those sleeper agents, those turncoats, would themselves be coated with a specially designed chemical that would give off the scent of a demon fox, that well-known, unmistakable fragrance, such that their neighbors would jump to the inevitable conclusion upon catching a whiff of eau de demon fox that they were possessed, as opposed to, say, unbathed. But the air and the balloon idea started to leak out, surely emitting the sound of a possessed demon fox as it did. Because how would they get these fox balloons to the Japanese mainland? In the fox whistles and the kitsune cologne? The Allies were losing men by the thousands, trying to string together a network of islands from which to hop one to the next to get close enough to Japan to launch aerial and amphibious assaults. Just how were they supposed to get their twee fox balloons there to bob about on wee little strings? And just who was this shadow army of secret fox whistleblowers and scent slatherers going to be? And if those people could be recruited, might there possibly be more strategically useful things to do than demon fox-based omen simulation? So back to the drawing board, where they had an epiphany. Why were they spending all this time making fake foxes when there were plenty of actual foxes running around? A real glowing fox beats an inflated glowing fox any day of the week, as the saying goes, so why overthink this? Get a fox, slap some glowing paint on it, and let it go wild. Imagine an invading army, ships on the horizon, howitzers thundering, U.S. Marines pouring out onto the shores of Hayama or Hamamatsu, guns blazing, rockets red glaring, while glowing spirit foxes scurried hither and yon on land. This idea was such a slam dunk, and the work of Operation Fantasia was so serious that the plan went all the way up to the top, to General MacArthur himself, who teeth clenched on his corncob pipe. Loved it, in principle. But he pointed out a problem. With no workable plan to train the painted foxes in the proper operation of parachutes, the animals would need to come ashore in the amphibious invasion. And paint, on fur, when wet, washes off. So. But with the fates of so many, of freedom itself at stake, the agents were undeterred. They ran experiments. They tested different types of paint. They tossed luminescent foxes into Chesapeake Bay, logged how much paint remained when they swam to shore, felt pretty pleased with the results. Enough of the paint remained such that the foxes, while less glowy, granted, were still pretty glowy. And one doesn't encounter foxes that are at all glowy, generally, so this was fairly spooky. At least until they noticed that the foxes had, rather than slink and pounce about omen-like in the fields, just stopped the second they got to shore and furiously licked themselves until they got all the paint off. So as one group went off to solve the problem of how to keep a wet spirit fox glowing, others got down to the central question. What would happen if unsuspecting people encountered these foxes out in the world? An account appeared in newspapers in 1948. 3 years after the end of the war, when many of its secrets began to be told. This one was about an evening in the summer of 1945, when 30 glowing foxes ran loose in Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. A statement from a Park Service official tasked with investigating the incident at the time said that parkgoers ran at the sight of the ghost-like animals, as though they had, quote, the screaming jimmies. Years later, declassified documents revealed that the agent saw this experiment as proof of concept. If a randomly selected group of hard-working God and country Americans freaked out, surely they could expect even better results from a backward people with deeply ingrained superstitions about magical foxes. They ramped up the program. They ordered the acquisition of more foxes in Allied territories. They would comb forests from the Cotswolds to Canberra to assemble a cadre of kitsune. And as they turned again to the logistical challenge of getting these creatures to the Japanese mainland, ahead of or concurrent with the invasion that would end the war, the project was over. Two bombs dropped on two Japanese cities over the span of 3 days killed somewhere between 110,000 and 210,000 civilians. In recent years, researchers and historians piecing together a fuller understanding of the operation have unearthed ongoing communications between OSS officials and Edgar Salinger, the businessman. In one exchange, he proposed creating a puppet, using the taxidermied body of a fox and replacing its head with a human skull, and then rigging it to fly up above the countryside on a balloon or kite. In another, they discuss a plan that would recruit more locals to act as if they were possessed by the foxes. They would wander around, spouting incoherent madness. A phrase that could be applied to Project Fantasia itself, in which one nation looked at another and at every turn, interpreted its actions and its people as motivated by ignorance and benighted delusion and amorality and buffoonery. Madness in a time of madness. to which we can now only look back and wonder at the spirits that possessed them and the strange things they made men do. This episode of the Memory Palace is written and produced by me, Nate DiMeo, in November of 2021. The show gets research assistance from Eliza McGraw. It is a proud member of Radiotopia, a network of listener-supported, independently owned and operated, self-funded, self-directed, non-corporate, non-venture capital-backed podcasts from PRX, a not-for-profit public media company dedicated to helping creators thrive on their own terms, each to their own needs, and according to their own ambitions. It is a good place to be. If you ever want to drop me a line to let me know what you think about the show, you can reach me personally. It is just me over here at the Palace. Find me at nate@thememorypalace.us, or you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook at The Memory Palace. And I will talk to you again.
Radiotopia from PRX.